Back together again, you and I chatting it up. Brand new week on Monday, the 22nd of September, 2025 on Connecticut Today. I opened the show talking about some recent comments made by Connecticut U.S. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy on the future of the National Democratic Party and its messaging. We welcomed a former U.S. Assistant Secretary for International Markets, Mitchell Silk, the author of A Seat at the Table, an Inside Account of Trump's Global Economic Revolution. He dropped by to chat about the current state of U.S. trade policy. And Connecticut News junkie, columnist, and Substack.com blogger Terry Cowgill rejoined the program to chat about several issues, including a possible state investment in the WNBA's Connecticut Sun. So I'm still not hearing it. As much as I strain my hearing here, which admittedly has been depleted by about 55 years of using headphones every day. But having said that, I strain my hearing every time I see somebody come on the television who doesn't like Donald Trump. And Lord knows, that's about half the country. All right, I get it. Two sides go back and forth. That's a good political give and take, right? We hear it all the time. We see it all the time. Trump is this, Trump is that. Now, frankly, he's not doing himself any favors, forcing Pam Bondi to go after Letitia James when apparently there's no criminality there, forcing Pam Bondi to go after, other people who've gone after him, which I think is useless. I know the guy's got a chip on his shoulder. Let it go. You won. They didn't. But having said that, we'll talk more about that later on in the show, because I think it's, frankly, a waste of time by the president and by the White House. But that's just me. He doesn't care, I don't think, what I say. But having said that, you constantly, especially this past weekend, on Saturday heading into Sunday, of course, with yesterday's memorial for Charlie Kirk in Arizona there at the stadium there in Glendale. A lot of people now are really, and I'm telling you, this is going to be the complete opposite of a kumbaya moment here. There are people, the partisanship is only going to ratchet up. And part of the problem that I see here is because you still have half the country saying, Trump's a bad guy, Trump sucks, Trump's no good, Trump bad, Trump bad, Trump bad. Okay, so I get it. I understand that. That's their right to say that. But again, I will ask over and over again, and I wanted to start with this today, because we're seeing all these allusions over the weekend that AOC may run for president, and now you have Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, sniping with the former vice president, Kamala Harris, about what she said in her book, and with good reason he should be upset with her. Now, we know why he wasn't given the VP nod, because he was Jewish. Everybody knows it. They'll all tiptoe around about it. But my point here is this. You have to have an alternative to Donald Trump. And man, this weekend, I hear all the sniping and I see all the sniping and all the back and forth on social media. And Charlie Kirk was a saint and Charlie Kirk was Satan and Charlie Kirk was something, you know, in the middle. All right, fine. Frankly, I don't care. I couldn't care less what anybody thought about Charlie Kirk. It's horrible what happened to him, obviously. This young kid allegedly who did this barbaric act on him. But again, you people on the other side of the Trump administration who seem to think that, you know, attacking Trump over and over again and attacking Charlie Kirk over and over again is going to actually win you anything? Really? You actually think that? Because if you haven't noticed, or if you have or haven't noticed, you've got no leader. You've got no platform. And as much as you may hate Donald Trump, letting loose with psychobabble about the American system is not going to fix anything. Now, I wanted to start off with this and this question. When we come back from the break here, I have a segment from who else, Connecticut Junior Democratic Senator Chris Murphy. He was on ABC yesterday. And he went for a few minutes about what Trump is doing is dangerous, sicking the FCC on broadcast outlets he doesn't like, which I agree with Chris Murphy on this. This is ridiculous. This whole Jimmy Kimmel thing. I mean, Jimmy Kimmel was making an abject fool of himself. Let him do it. Don't fire him. Let him do it. He's got a year left on his contract, and the late-night shows are going away anyway, Mr. President, so don't do it. But the bottom line is this. At the end, there was an exchange between Jonathan Karl of ABC and our Chris Murphy that shows you the abject train wreck that the modern-day Democratic Party is in. And I'm serious about this, and I only say this because I ask you people who are against Trump and anti-MAGA, your side had better come up with something and come up soon, with it soon, because Trump stinks is not a viable campaign platform. It's just not. So let's start with a question first, and I'll come back and we'll get your thoughts on this at 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Now we'll come back with Jonathan Karl and Chris Murphy, because Chris Murphy was asked a legitimate question and he delivered a minute of psychobabble, a minute of a word salad that would have brought tears to the eyes of Kamala Harris, who herself can't put three words in a row. But I'll ask this, looking ahead to 2026 and 2028, do you think, whether or not you are pro-Trump or anti-Trump, pro-Ned Lamont, anti-Ned Lamont, whatever, because it pertains to even down to local stuff here in Connecticut, looking ahead to 2026 and 2028, are the present-day Democratic Party policies too conservative? Are they too liberal? Or are they just about right? Now, you folks on the left, you better figure that out. Because if you don't do that and run AOC for the White House in 2028 or for the Senate in 2026, you're crazy. Now, I may be wrong saying that, but you're crazy. So you tell me, especially if you're anti-Trump, but even if you're pro-Trump or pro-GOP or pro-MAGA or anti-MAGA, frankly, I don't care. I'll take a call from anybody on this. But again, looking ahead to 2026 and 2028, are the present-day Democratic Party policies too conservative, too liberal, or just about right? And don't go away, because coming back, more psychobabble from our friend Chris Murphy. So over the weekend, obviously, with the Charlie Kirk Memorial, and a lot of people were moved by that. Some people hated it. Frankly, I don't care. I don't care what you watch, who you like, who you don't. What I do care about, though, is that you look clear-eyed at things. And everybody's saying, hey, you know, this is horrible. Trump's going after people who tried to get him in trouble. And he is, which I think is a waste of time, because it's not going to shift anything. And he could really wreck it for the generations of leaders after that. But again, as I read early on in the first go-around with the whole Russia thing, people were warning Democrats, saying, hey, he won't forget it. He'll make your life a living hell. It's what's happening right now. But my further question is, looking ahead to 2026 and 2028, because you're going to have to win this on policy. Trump is not going to be around forever. All right. He's not running for another term after this. Get that out of your mind. So looking ahead to the midterms next year, and whomever runs in 2028, probably J.D. Vance, but we don't know that. Are the present day Democratic Party policies too conservative, too liberal, or just about right? And is the Democratic Party heading in a bad direction? Especially if you're a proud card-carrying Democrat. I want you to listen to this. This is Jonathan Karl yesterday on ABC's This Week. ABC, hardly a right-wing outlet. And he had Chris Murphy on. And they did the first segment of the interview about what Murphy thinks is dangerous with Trump and the FCC. And by the way, I agree with him on that. I don't care what a late-night comedian says. You can't use a federal agency to come down on them. If I was president, who cares what some, you know, what a guy who used to do the man show and laugh at girls on trampolines in sweaters. But am I going to view him as a political foe? No, but that's not what Trump does. But having said that, here's Jonathan Karl on ABC asking Chris Murphy, hey, Chris, your party, we know you don't like Trump, but your party kind of likes socialism.
There was a poll out about the Democratic Party. There was a poll out earlier this month from Gallup that asked views of socialism and capitalism. And I want to take a look at this part of that poll. It showed that 66% of Democrats have a favorable view of socialism. Independents, 38%, just 38%. Republicans, 14%. Is that the future of the Democratic Party? is a more favorable view of socialism?
No, it is not. But I have seen, I think, even more interesting polling that shows you across party identities, people in this country are sick and tired of corporations having so much control over our lives and are sick and tired of work not paying. So I think the Democratic Party has an opportunity to reach into Donald Trump's base to really build upon a potential realignment in this country if we are aggressively talking about deconstructing concentrated corporate power, including in the media, and we are talking about fundamentally increasing the amount of money that people make and the protections that they have when they go to work. That's not socialism. That's just right-sizing the economy so that people have power instead of corporations having power. And frankly, I think that's, you know, why a candidate like Mondami in New York is doing so well, because he's talking about transitioning power from people that don't have it to people that have it. So I think that's the message that ultimately has the potential to unite a lot of right and left.
Oh, my God. Is he serious with that? That sounded like, as James Carville likes to say, faculty lounge BS. Oh, my God. See, you're never going to defeat the MAGA movement, Senator, until you address other things, too. How do they feel on crime? How about immigration? How about the border? But no, it's just he comes up. They all come up with this. You ask them, hey, why is Trump winning? And they immediately deflect it. Well, concentrated wealth. And people feel they're not getting ahead. And they're, you know, just stop. He's going to reach, the Democrats are going to reach into Trump's base with that gobbledygook. Come on, stop it. I'm not saying you can't reach into Trump's base. You know, you want to know how to reach into Trump's base? Come out harder on crime. And don't start waving, you know, figures in people's faces. Well, you know, we have to look at the numbers here and the relative mean, median, and the average of crime. Now, in fact, after the break, I have an example of how one crazy member of the House can derail everything Chris Murphy just said. He can pontificate about, well, we need to do this, and from a socioeconomic background, and, you know, from doing this and applying the logic of the socioeconomic freedom. No, and then that can be destroyed with one person who, I got to tell you, they got to rein her in. I think you know who we're talking about. But I got a line coming up from her that if Chris Murphy here heard this, or Dick Blumenthal heard this, or even if Rosa DeLauro heard this, they're going to face plant. So again, Chris Murphy can talk all he wants and everybody else about, well, we have to reach into the Trump base because we have certain socioeconomic considerations. Oh, stop. Stop it. My God. Are you people going to wake up? You wonder why Trump won? You wonder why he won the popular vote? And now he doesn't have to worry about running for re-election again? Come on. Jeez. Jose in Shelton's here. Jose, how are you?
How you doing, Paul?
Hey.
Long time no talk.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah, you tell me. What's wrong with your party, Jose? Oh, well, my God.
My party is just sleeping at the wheel. That's what's wrong with my party. But here's the thing, Paul.
Yeah.
I got the winning ticket for 2028.
Go ahead.
If Trump decides to step down.
Okay.
If he decides to step down.
Okay.
Here's the winning ticket.
I'm ready.
I got a couple of combinations you can put together.
Okay.
Newsom, Pitzer.
Newsom and who?
The governor from Illinois.
Pritzker.
Or.
Yeah.
Pritzker, whatever.
Yeah. His name isn't Pritzker, Jesus. Yeah.
Okay. Or Newsom Whitmer from Michigan.
All right, maybe. Maybe.
Or, all right, I'm on a roll.
Okay.
Or.
Yeah.
Or Newsom.
Yeah.
The one from Pennsylvania.
Josh, or a combination
of any.
Okay. Well, the governor of Pennsylvania
is the winning ticket.
Well, here's and Jose, thank you for the call. I got to run. Here's the problem with Gavin Newsom. He uses too much hair product. Okay, Whitmer, I don't know. J.B. Pritzker got caught palling around with some gangbanger. I got that story coming up. And Josh Shapiro there. Well, the problem with Josh Shapiro is he's Jewish. And a lot of the far left of the Democratic Party, they don't like that. Our next guest, let's get serious here. We're welcoming a former Assistant Secretary for International Markets at the U.S. Department of Treasury and the first Hasidic Jew ever confirmed by the Senate for a senior federal role. He has over 30 years of law and finance experience. He's led significant trade agreements and infrastructure initiatives globally. He's a graduate of Georgetown and the University of Maryland School of Law. He's fluent in Mandarin and Cantonese, actively engages in pro bono work with the Jewish community, currently serves as Group General Counsel of Waterton Global Resources and the Cedarfield Group. The guest is Mitchell A. Silk, and Mitchell's new book is called A Seat at the Table, an inside account of Trump's global economic revolution. Mitchell, hi, it's Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. How you doing? Thank you so much for having me today.
Boy, again, a long line of guests who has a much better resume than I do, Mitchell. You certainly look like you're knee-deep in all this trade policy and international negotiations. And why the book here, A Seat at the Table? Why'd you feel the need to write this, Mitchell? And what would the casual reader, who may not be, Mitchell, really involved in this stuff, what would they get out of this?
Well, really three levels of that, Paul. It all comes down to the title, A Seat at the Table. And I, at its most basic level, I wanted to hit three dimensions of A Seat at the Table. Mm-hmm. The dimension of the country, the dimension of myself having a seat at the table, and aspirationally, the dimension of every person, including everybody that's listening, having a seat at the table for themselves. So let me unpack that for a minute.
Sure.
At its highest level, the president during Trump 45, and he's continued really out of the gate at a sprint, ensuring that he has secured a seat of leadership for the country at the table based on firm policy that puts the United States first. So the overarching theme throughout the book is POTUS giving us a seat at the table, appropriately pursuing national interests in ways that are good for the American people, mm-hmm. and good for jobs and recreating the industrial base. A little bit more basic than that.
Yeah.
This is more than a policy book. It's about me, and it's about my background. My grandparents came to this great country from Eastern Europe in the early 1900s, and I learned a ton from them, a lot of good old world teachings and learning. You left out from the introduction that I'm also fluent in Yiddish, which is my most favorite language,
yeah.
and I love to use a nice piece of Yiddish humor here and there to help things along. And so really, of my four P's, which are perseverance, progress over perfection, divine providence, and a personal touch, I use a lot of the book and the examples of the book to show how impactful a personal touch could be in furthering national interest. And finally, for every person, kind of aspirationally, mm-hmm. I wanted to show everybody in the country that they can make a difference, and they can and should have a seat at the table in helping our country along at this time. So really, when it comes down to it, Paul, I wanted to show how perseverance, how a personal touch, how some good old American grit can change the world and can change policy.
What is your reaction, Mitchell? And the guest is Mitchell Silk. The name of the book is A Seat at the Table. What is your reaction then, Mitchell, to people who might not agree with you on the Trump methods here and saying this is ridiculous with trade and the tariffs? He's being too ham-fisted here. He should use a scalpel and not a sledgehammer. What do you say to those people? And I'm sure you've heard those criticisms.
Yeah, and I could see where folks would be coming from. I could see where folks might have that view, and I think it's really the difference between folks that are protractors who say that the tariffs have brought chaos, and that the tariffs have been opposed in the form of punishment. From my standpoint, I see the tariffs as strategic art. I call it 3D chess that the president has utilized and implemented to the great benefit of the country and the people. And I see it that way because all we need to do is to look at the basic data to see how accretive and how impactful the president has achieved success by using the tariffs as leverage. So again, let me unpack that one.
Sure.
The president started the term January 21st, 2025, faced with a $1.2 trillion trade deficit. That's a lot of money. Massive macroeconomic impacts for the country, massive impacts on our industrial base, massive impacts on labor. And so what the president set out to do was to use tariffs as a disruptive, highly focused, faster and more strategic tool to get at this massive piece of $1.2 trillion in trade deficit. If we fast forward to 6 months into the term, the president, through his great negotiating team comprised of folks at Treasury and at USTR and Commerce, and of course the White House itself, secured deals with, let's call it, around 10 countries, including Japan, the EU, countries and regions, the EU, South Korea, Indonesia, Philippines, and Vietnam, where he had settled agreements with all of those countries, and those countries on a combined basis represent around $809 billion of the $1.2 trillion in deficit. So that's around 67% of the deficit. So he put to bed and calmed, reached closure on a large piece of this economic position detrimental to the country, with a couple of additional benefits. And the benefits are as follows. Deficit is deficit. Dealing with the deficit is dealing with the deficit. But in addition to reaching agreement on trade issues, import and export issues with those countries, for a number of the countries, he also, like with Japan, secured multi-hundred million dollar commitments for them to invest in our country, revitalizing the industrial base and bringing jobs here. And in addition to that, with a couple of the countries, including South Korea, Indonesia, and Japan, he secured very large sales agreements for the export of U.S. liquefied natural gas, which is in furtherance of the president's energy dominance policy. So some great benefits above and beyond trade simply, but really what I see as one of the greatest results of the policy is that he's cleared the decks with the majority of the larger deficit countries in order to bring focus and use our limited resources on a very focused basis to really address the China issue, which represents the lion's share of the remaining deficit numbers. So that's my take, Paul.
See
that.
And Mitchell, no, it's okay. In about the 1 minute we have left, Mitchell, I'm squeezed for time here. You mentioned China. Give us a quick minute on what it's like to try and negotiate these deals with the Chinese.
Well, you know, they are they're the master of slow roll. The master of bureaucracy, the master of changing things up at the last minute. And I go through some very serious moments and some lighter humorous moments in my book, A Seat at the Table. But, you know, in a word, in contrast with the practice during the Obama administration, what we saw coming to the table is that the president and our team had formulated a very solid set of positions We did not flinch. We did not budge. We showed them at the table, meeting after meeting, that we meant business. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, the reason why we brought home the Phase One trade agreement and why we ultimately will be successful during Trump 47 to bring home a good agreement with China for our country.
All right. Important stuff, folks. Fascinating. A Seat at the Table, the author Mitchell Silk, an inside account of Trump's global economic revolution. Mitchell, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And hopefully we can chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me, Paul. Have a great day.
Thank you, Mitchell. You too. Mitchell Silk, the name of the book is A Seat at the Table.
I think you know that sort of the market rate for the team, if you did the whole transaction, was about $325 million, and we would maybe do a half of that and have others for the other half. If it's a minority interest that keeps the team more or less where it is, our share would be obviously much less than that.
Save the Sun. Now, I played that earlier. We'll do it again coming up later as well. But now you have state employees and AFSCME local on their Facebook page saying, Governor, please, no. Don't take our pension money and do that. Let them leave. That's my idea. Let them leave. But let me ask this gentleman who rejoins us. You read his stuff at the Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com. Also at Substack, not enough caffeine today, Substack.com, red meat for mushy moderates. Terry Cowgill back with us. Mr. Cowgill, how are you, sir?
Hey, not bad, thank you. Glad to be back in Connecticut. And there's no shortage of things to write about and think about in this state, too.
So the state, or at least the governor, Terry, and some people saying, hey, why don't we try and retain the Connecticut Sun here, the team valued at about $350 million. It's kind of clear, Terry, from my inkling, it looks like this might be another Whalers thing where the league wants the team out. You mentioned it's not completely unheard of to have governments getting together with private industry. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, you know, I thought about this well before Governor Lamont actually announced that he had this plan to have the state invest in the Connecticut Sun to keep him here and move him to the Hartford Civic Center, because as you may recall, the Trump administration essentially bought a 10% stake in Intel, the chip company.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is very strange. Why, you know, it really is. It's socialism is what it is. It's either crony capitalism or socialism. Pick your poison, I would say.
Yeah, right.
So, and then I saw that Lamont had this plan, and I thought, I didn't like it, obviously, because I think it is crony capitalism again. But my problem with it is that, you can put this stuff in, you can invest teachers' pensions and state workers' pension in this.
Yeah.
But the difference is, I think, is that the state treasurer, and that would be Aaron Russell, he's supposed to make it, and I have no reason to doubt this, he is supposed to make pension investment decisions based on how stable the stock is, how well it performs, and how well he can protect the interests of the state employees and their pensions.
Yep.
And this is not being made, this decision, if it comes through, to invest, I don't know how many millions, into the Connecticut Sun and then build this practice arena, is not being made using the same criteria as the others are. So how stable is this? How good a bet is this? Well, we don't actually know. Obviously, Mr. Russell would have to sign off on it.
Yeah.
But I just think that this is not the criteria that we should use for investing what are supposed to be very secure pension funds for state employees and teachers.
And Terry, what would happen here? You know, unlike really stable stocks like Apple or maybe Disney, and we'll get to that, you know, the mega stocks, what if the team's attendance goes down? What if, you know, the revenue, the signage isn't there, whatever? Would there then be pressure to say, hey, there's state money here, Terry. We have to raise the beer prices, or we have to raise the soda and hot dog prices. I mean, right there, to me, that's where you'd have a lot of, a lot of difficulty. I think I might be wrong, but I don't know.
Well, and then what happens if the something happens with the Connecticut Sun, they wind up going bankrupt or something?
Yeah.
Then what happens? Well, all of that taxpayer money gets wasted.
Mm-hmm.
And then presumably they'd have to raise taxes to cover it or borrow for it. I don't know what it is, but I can't, full disclosure, I don't follow the Connecticut Sun.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in them at all.
Yeah.
I love UConn women's basketball.
Sure.
And they're my favorite team really to follow in the state.
Yeah.
But this is just a bridge too far for me.
Well, Terry Cowgill, the guest from the Connecticut News Junkie and Substack.com, red meat for mushy moderates. All right, Terry, a couple of very serious issues. First time we've spoken in a while. And obviously the tragic assassination, basically what it was, of Charlie Kirk. And I know some people loved him. A lot of people never heard of him before this. Some people couldn't stand him. But, you know, no matter what your thoughts on that, I've been telling people, Terry, just a horrible thing. And to see that video was just, you talk about something that just made, I think, an entire nation shudder.
Well, I had the misfortune of, after it happened, I was doom scrolling on X,
mm-hmm.
Now formerly Twitter.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to see what was happening. And I did manage to, scroll past the video. Somebody had it on an endless loop. And I just I wanted to avert my eyes immediately because it was just it was like. You know, it was almost as bad as watching the Zapruder film. You know, I mean,
yes.
Charlie Kirk, he wasn't the president of the United States, but still, he was a thought leader, and he had millions of followers, and there he was doing what he loved to do best, and he was cut down in broad daylight like that. Mm-hmm. What I did see though on X was immediately the finger pointing starting.
Yep.
And it was basically, they did this to us. Mm-hmm. Megyn Kelly got right into it. They did this to us. They, and I'm thinking to myself, well, who is they? They didn't have a suspect at that point. And it turns out it was a lone gunman, as far as we know. And he was raised in a Mormon family, a church-going Mormon family. He obviously became radicalized online.
Mm-hmm.
I became kind of depressed about it because I was afraid that it was going to spark more violence and that we would see maybe some retaliation. And despite all of the, agitprop that I saw on places like Twitter, it did not materialize.
No.
And I'm thankful for that. I'm sure you are, too.
Oh, absolutely, Terry. I always say on this show, I think 90% of the people in this country can comport themselves fine. There's the 5% on the far, far right and the 5% on the far, far right that really are the bane right now of our politics. Speaking of that, this whole thing with Jimmy Kimmel coming back tomorrow and what he said and the innuendo that apparently came, from the White House and maybe affected the FCC chairman. You know, Terry, I look for maybe the good in all this when these things happen. And at least it has, my friend, generated a good amount of discussion, pro and con, about influence, corporate influence, governmental influence, and what exactly the First Amendment says.
Yeah, and I think we all need a refresher from time to time,
mm-hmm.
on the First Amendment.
Yep.
And, I would urge people to go back and see it or just read it. And that textually, it's very, very significant. And in terms of rights, of course, it's very, very significant. And that's the reason that it literally is the First Amendment. The founders gave it that high of an importance.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, we all know now, I think, that you're not supposed to be punished for speech. And certainly to have the government, I mean, you can be punished in the marketplace for
sure.
your speech,
yep.
obviously, but you're not the government should not put its thumb on the scale and basically hold up mergers in return for, paying these fines or paying as in the case with Donald Trump when he sued CBS for 60 Minutes, that edited segment with Kamala Harris.
Yep.
Basically, you know, CBS had a merger with Skydance that was pending before the FCC, and Trump sued them. It was a ludicrous, completely meritless lawsuit, but CBS went ahead and paid $15 million directly to Donald Trump, and they got their merger approved. So I think there are a lot of problems with the First Amendment right now, and I think we all need to take a deep breath and try to take it very seriously before things go even further awry.
Yeah, and Terry, in about the 90 seconds or 2 minutes we have left, I wanted to ask you this, and I've taken a lot of calls on this today and a lot of social media postings as well. The country essentially knows what Donald Trump is as a politician. You know, he came down the staircase. Oh, yeah, the guy that's on The Celebrity Apprentice. Well, we know what's happened over the past 10 years and probably another two. If you're the Democratic Party, what do you do? There's a lot of people out there, and there's a question of, well, Trump still wins on key issues that maybe the Democrats don't have a broad enough tent on. What, Terry, going into, say, at least the 2026, you know, midterms here and maybe eyeing 2028? I mean, I've taken numerous calls on this. Does the Democratic Party get back to, I don't know, the Bill Clinton era, the Barack Obama era, you know, suffice to say the JFK era? What does the party of FDR do now?
Yeah, well, first of all, they need a leader, and they don't have one. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of, you can say the Republican Party is going awry. There's all kinds of problems with the Republican Party.
Yeah.
They do have a leader, for better or worse,
and
we know it's Donald Trump. He's not going to be around, I would say, he's not going to be around that much longer. He's older than Biden when he took office.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see how long he lasts. But they need a leader, and Chuck Schumer clearly isn't it. And the, you know, the rumors, of course, is that AOC is going to run against, or it's going to primary him.
Yeah.
In 2 years, I believe it is, when he's up for reelection. But she's probably too far to the left to attract other people. They've got, Mamdani, who is now the Democratic nominee for governor or for mayor of New York City. So they've got a very noisy left flank, and then they've got people who are more moderate, and we've got some representing us right here. People like Jim Hines, I think, is fairly moderate, Joe Courtney.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what they need to do is move a little further to the center and really try to appeal to working people. But it's very difficult to do that when you're leaders don't send off a working class vibe at all.
Yeah. Terry Cowgill, Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com and substack.com. Red meat for mushy moderates. Terry, have a good week, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
All right, Paul. Nice to talk to you again.
All right. Terry Cowgill back on the program today after a couple of months off.